Hello and welcome to this bonus edition of the TES podcast. I'm senior editor Simon Locke, and today I'll be speaking to one of the most influential figures in educational psychology, Professor John Dunlosky. His research, Strengthening the Student Toolbox, identifies the most effective strategies students can use to boost learning and is referenced repeatedly when it comes to revision. In this exclusive interview, we look at how teachers can use these strategies to create better learners beyond just the exam period, and ask whether the focus on knowledge over study skills is undermining a school's catch-up efforts. This conversation took place over Zoom, and there are a few slight glitches, but hopefully that won't detract from John's wise words. If you want to hear more from John, he'll be one of the keynote speakers at next year's World Education Summit, hosted online in March. To find a full list of speakers and book your place, visit worldedsummit.com. TES will again be providing extensive coverage of the event, so keep an eye on our social channels for previews and the chance to get your hands on some free tickets. But for now, here's my chat with Professor John Dunlosky. John, welcome to the TES podcast. Thank you so much for joining me today.
My pleasure.
Now, you're coming to us live from Ohio in the US via Zoom. How's life over there? Have you managed to take some vacation, have something like a normal summer?
You know, we tried our best to get one, and it turns out just as we were gearing up to take a small little vacation, driving down to Mississippi to see friends, the pandemic reared its ugly head again, so we had to cancel that. So it's been more of a work-focused summer. It's all right. Looking forward to next year.
Another summer of disappointment. I know we've sort of crept back into normality here with trepidation. But unfortunately, the weather has been a bit of a letdown, so it's not going to be a summer to remember, that's for sure.
No, it's been tough because we had that month, maybe 2 months, of thinking that we were in the clear.
Yeah.
And that we were ripping off the COVID Band-Aid. And unfortunately, that just was not the case for all the reasons we know about at this point. And so we're probably heading back to lockdown again, but okay. Not for too long.
Well, I don't know how much you can say, but is there anything you've been working on over the summer that you're particularly excited about? You can say you'd rather not say if you should prefer.
No, you know, the work we tend to do, you know, as scientists is often a relatively solitary activity. So working on several manuscripts that I'm very excited about, reporting the latest and greatest research doing with collaborator Catherine Rawson on successive relearning, and gearing up to do quite a bit of remote data collection to understand how some of these techniques can help students out in chemistry courses, biology courses, and so forth, something that at least the technology we're developing and interested in exploring is something that really is best done remote anyway. So at least there's a happy alignment with the pandemic that our research was going to take place remote anyway. So we've been able to move forward with it. But I've been doing quite a bit research-wise. It's been a good summer.
Keeping busy. Good stuff. I hope you don't mind me saying, but you're a sort of almost what you'd call a household name in education circles. I think based off your 2013 piece of research, Strengthening the Student Toolbox. Why do you think that piece of research really hit home and really reached audiences and became that sort of piece of heavyweight thinking that teachers refer to?
That's a great question. Quite frankly, Simon, one that I haven't really thought deeply about. I'm, of course, very happy that it has had, I think, a positive impact. And, I think prior to that particular monograph coming out, there were quite a few other really valuable overviews of the field that I think made many of the same conclusions. So it was more about our really excellent team kind of putting it all together during a kind of a bird's eye view of all of those literatures. Then I think our take-home message, and this is kind of important for anyone else endeavoring to have a high impact with these kind of monographs, the take-home messages were really easily pulled from tables and figures. So you didn't have to slog through that incredibly long article to really get a bird's eye on what was working well and so forth. So I think, you know, anyone else in the area could have written a quality monograph just like we did there. And I think the impact is just because it was highly accessible. And the take-home messages were straightforward. And thank goodness, many of the study strategies to build a better learner that we thought were most valuable are relatively easily to implement. So not only do you have a straightforward take-home message, but then I think many of the things we recommended teachers do, something that they could, you know, grab onto and try out in their own classroom. So I think it was just a happy combination of multiple events that made that such a, I think, impactful piece of research.
Yeah, this was aligned. Yeah. Yeah, for anyone listening who hasn't seen the research, it's essentially a piece of, sort of meta research, I guess, looking at study strategies that students can use to better remember, better learn. And I guess there's been a bit of a cognitive science revolution within in education in recent years, and I guess you were sort of a little bit ahead of the curve back in 2013. It seems to have really, at least in the UK, sort of reached a peak. How do you think the use of research in teaching has impacted education? And are there pros and cons? Is there areas where perhaps research is sort of misunderstood? What's your take on it?
Well, as far as just the impact on day-to-day teaching activities, my guess is that, and my hope is that, the research is eventually filtering down and helping teachers just do a better job at engaging in activities that there's some evidence that suggests they would really work, versus getting excited about the next new fancy, shiny educational technique that comes down, which are exciting to use, but as we know, aren't often evidence-based. So what I do see, though, is I think a very slow trickle-down of evidence-based education research to practices across the board. So many of us may have been a little bit ahead of the curve, but that curve is moving relatively slowly. So what I see here is that, no surprise, that if there are any larger reforms, those are happening first at the university levels, because much of the research is going on at the university levels. And thank goodness, because of events like World Education Symposiums and all these other wonderful conferences that teachers are now flocking to, we have had a chance as education researchers to at least get the message out. But as you know, as someone in media, you can get the message out a lot. It doesn't mean it's heard or translated. So I think this is a very slow process. I'm psyched that there are avenues like talking with you so I can and touch and get connected with educators. But I wish there were even more of that. In my, for my particular taste, I know quite a few folks in my position who've been wanting to really have a larger impact on education and felt like we've been a little bit tripped up by the fact that we're not sure how to contact and talk to teachers, because after all, Simon, we tend to be scientists. Again, we do much of our research closed, locked in our in our offices. So I think the impact we're making, I think especially in the UK, is impressive, but I wish we could even increase the impact and get even better evidence-based practices out there to teachers. It's just a slow moving barge, but thank goodness it's moving in the right direction.
Yeah, great. Well, like you say, perhaps the reason your research really hit home was it was digestible and could be applied quite easily, and teachers latched onto that.
Absolutely. And quite frankly, a couple of decisions we made when we were writing this article was to only evaluate the effectiveness of techniques that would be free. And note, many of the new educational technologies are anything but free. And imagine you're sitting at a sixth grade class wanting to develop or take on a new technology to help your students. You just don't have hundreds or thousands of dollars to buy the latest technology. Well, what we had to offer were, here's some things that you could do without any cost to see if it could benefit your students. So there are a lot of barriers to overcome in implementing any new technology. And I think, again, one of them is that many of these educational advances often come with a relatively high price tag. And I wish that weren't the case, but it's just a reality. So,
yeah. Do you think, your strategies, do you think there's enough of a balance in Western education between the teaching of knowledge and the teaching of strategies for learning, both kind of your sort of study strategies, but also perhaps socio-emotional strategies as well, and coping with anxiety and things like that? Do you think there's enough of a balance at the moment?
No. In fact, the imbalance is so extreme, it's almost, it's shocking. I mean, very little focus is made on training students to become better learners. And certainly not, although at least at college levels, which I'm mainly involved with, I know there's much more support for socio-emotional development and support. I think we need more of that K through 12. In fact, when I get students at the university level, I don't want to say it's too late, because many of the strategies that they can use to become more effective learners are not that difficult to use. Things like time management, retrieval practice, space practice, and so forth. But I think really the time to begin in building a more effective learner is starting very early on. Many of these strategies are simple. And to begin training students and giving them a complete toolbox of strategies that they can utilize to learn anything, I think we need to do a lot more of that early on and integrate them with curriculum. So that knowledge, of course, we all agree is absolutely essential for any kind of critical thinking, for workplace, for developing into, a good citizen of your where you live. Absolutely critical. But it would be super if we started even third, fourth grade, showing students how to actually gain that knowledge in the most effective ways so that they can more quickly turn into independent learners, right? So they won't need the crutch of a, say, instructor, so to speak, so they could learn by themselves. So I wish there were a whole lot more of that going on. Let me qualify this, however. I absolutely understand what teachers are up against with respect to helping their students obtain a certain level of knowledge, especially here in the States, where those students need to pass a variety of different statewide tests and exam that evaluates them on their knowledge and doesn't evaluate them on the quality of the learning strategies and their independence as learners. So I think this is important to work on this imbalance. However, how exactly to do it so that teachers have enough time to not only basically instruct their students and introduce them to all the knowledge they need, but in the same hand, allowing them to use effective strategies, you know, to get that experience of how well they could work when they're learning that knowledge. So yeah, I think it's incredible imbalance at all levels. K through 12, college, and so forth. And I'm trying to make a little mark here at Kent State and make that imbalance a little bit less, but it's just a little bit less.
So you said these strategies should be taught quite early on. Are you, what stage should teachers be thinking about perhaps trying to infuse these into their teaching and learning?
Let's take a simple example I think might help. Here in the States, everywhere across the world, students need to learn to spell. Spelling is, turns out, a pretty important activity to spell correctly. And we have them use a variety of different techniques early on to learn to spell. And that's a great time to implement something like retrieval practice. That is, often to engage students, we have them do things like, and I'm talking first, second graders, you might have them use a variety of different colored pencils. It's called rainbow writing, to write words in different colors. Totally acceptable, wonderful, okay? Because it's exciting and, you know, what child, what adult doesn't want to write in different colors? So imagine now taking rainbow writing where they're usually transcribing, that is, they're looking at the word they're supposed to spell and they're just spelling it over. Well, instead of doing that way, have them use retrieval practice. So you say the word apple, and now you have the students spell that from memory. The retrieval attempt itself has a valuable impact on the student's retention of spelling, it turns out. And it also is the case that students initially tend to find that retrieval practice a little bit awkward. That is, it's a little bit more demanding. It feels a little bit less uncomfortable. But at least the first graders, second graders we've worked with also find it kind of like a game. That is, it's kind of fun because now instead of just copying something, you're seeing if you can actually get it from memory. So I think early on, teachers can begin using these practices so the students can get used to them and see their impact. Whether just implementing that at first, second, third grade will have a long-term impact on students' use of those strategies, I think that's an empirical question we need to learn. That is, how much experience students need with these strategies to adopt them, we don't know yet. But I suspect the earlier we begin introducing them in the classroom, the larger impact they'll have. At least I think that's a promissory note. So many of these strategies, they get just to cut to the chase, Simon, are so easy to implement that we can begin using them earlier. And we have evidence that they work for children of very young ages.
Do you, in your experience, do you see, for example, in a secondary school, you might a student might move with between sort of three or four teachers during a day, all with their own teaching styles, techniques. Do you think that these strategies should sit outside of that, or should all educators be embedding them? Or how have you seen this work? Are they sort of explicitly taught outside of subjects?
I hope there are districts that are considering kind of more global use of these strategies across classes. I think that's how they could work the best. So if, as you move from class to class, teacher to teacher, if they tend to be using the same set of effective strategies, maybe the students would then, the light bulb would go off and they'd realize, ooh, these are working in all of these different classes. I think, of course, the challenge is getting all the teachers on the same page with this. And that's most likely to happen at a higher level where administration, superintendents, school principals realize that this is a good direction so that they're overlaying strategy instruction, developing independent self-regulation skills on top of the content to make it kind of a group effort. I think it would work the best way. Again, in the United States, some teachers might view that as a little bit pushy, so to speak, as violating their freedom of teaching rights. I think, though, when teachers start seeing the benefits of these strategies and actually start seeing their students perform better, however, I think it might also start this revolution of really focused more on training the students on how to learn better, which I think is going to free up time in the classroom for higher quality instruction, because now the students, when they say go home at night and do their little bit of homework they have to do, they're doing it in a more effective and efficient way so that they're even more prepared when they come back to class the next time. But I think, again, to kind of summarize, I think probably the best way to attack this is to have groups of teachers work together to figure out what strategies could really be effective across content so the students get the same message in each class.
Yeah, I guess there's a few sort of jostling priorities, aren't there? In this country, as students are going back, there's a lot of talk around gaps in knowledge. So people are focusing on, you know, what's been missed during lockdown. And there's also, you know, the well-being angle. And now if you think about the teaching strategies, it's like, I guess one of the blockers might be that how do you make sure all of these priorities are aligned? But it's a difficult one.
But it's just a major challenge. And quite frankly, time is a zero-sum game. Teachers only have so much time. Students and parents only have so much time. And it's unfortunate that at least some of these strategies that lead to long-term retention and durable learning will eventually lead to this savings of time because they tend to be more efficient in the long run. to gain that knowledge. So it's going to be a trade-off. It's, again, like I said earlier, this is a slow-moving barge. I think as more and more teachers find out about how well some strategies work, like simply retrieval practice, successive relearning, and so forth, more and more will start using those in their classes and with their students, and hopefully we'll have a larger sea change. But it's going to take some time.
So you talked about making these strategies available to children early on. Is there a danger that sort of repeating certain strategies over and over might get to a point where students feel turned off, for example, from practice testing or retrieval practice, where they get sort of saturated with it? Or is it better to keep doing these things and make them sort of almost innate in the learner's mind? Is there a balance there that educators need to strike?
Well, you know, I hope that's an empirical question, Simon. That is, as we do more and more of this, I think we have to assess the long-term impact. My hope, though, is that as students use them more and more, they'll realize, wow, this is the way to go when I really want to have durable learning. So many of the strategies that I recommend students use, like successive relearning, which is to learn something once and then to go back and relearn it, do take time, and you would not want to use it on all of the materials you want to learn. So I think as students begin using this, they'll realize, wow, when I use this strategy, I really excel and I can master content. So it comes down to then the student making a, quite frankly, an educated decision about what do I really want to learn well versus what do I just want to get by on? And that's a sophisticated learner, right? And to give them the tools, the strategies, so that when they make the decision, hey, this particular content and course is critical for me, I'm going to use these really effective strategies because I can and know I can master something. I think that's where we want to get students to. And quite frankly, they use the same strategies all the time and don't get really tired of them. The students reread a lot. They go back, look over their notes. So this is just something else they should get kind of used to doing. I don't think they would become saturated. And certainly when they finally get out of the school system, at least they'll have something invaluable they could take with them. So when they're getting that first job and others are struggling to, say, learn the rule book of the job, they'll excel because they can apply this really effective strategy. So, I think if we begin early, it's the best chance of developing good habits. And just strangely enough, on a side, many of the most effective strategies, say, such as successive relearning, these students use it all the time to learn activities outside of academia, outside of the classroom. So we know students are good at playing video games, they're good at dance, they're good at sports. Well, they're using really effective strategies to excel at those. All we want them to do is use the same strategies to excel in the classroom. So I think they're ready for it. It's just showing them that these things work well.
That's interesting, because is there an argument that perhaps these strategies should be made more explicit and the gains more explicit? Because I just thinking back to my time at school and thinking about practice testing, which your study showed to be really effective, but I was probably turned off it by just the anxiety around testing, and probably wasn't sold the benefit, wasn't told, oh, but by doing this, you're increasing your chances of retaining the information. Is there a job for educators to do to sort of sell the benefits?
Yeah, I think so. Which makes the educator's job that much more challenging, right? I mean, you know that sometimes an important aspect of an educator is just to convince the students that the knowledge they're teaching will benefit the students, right? A major complaint students, at least in the States, often have is, why am I sitting in this course? There's no benefit of the knowledge. Well, they also have to probably not only be shown, but experience the benefit of these strategies to really embrace them. It reminds me There's some wonderful work coming out of Phil Higham's lab in the UK, where he was using successive relearning within an introductory psychology course. Now, this is at the university level. And he had the students use both successive relearning, which is retrieval practice until you hit a criterion, and then coming back and doing it again. And he also had the students use basically restudying, that is rereading the content. And the students went and used successive relearning, then they did a bit of rereading, and they did this back and forth throughout the entire semester. And the two things I'd like to highlight: when the students use successive relearning, that is the good strategy, they retain more. That won't surprise anyone. What I found really exciting about this research is that Dr. Higham also had the students rate their anxiety level and how much they were learning throughout the semester. And at the beginning of the semester, the students said they were more anxious and were learning less when they used successive relearning. Okay. No doubt they were more anxious, but we know they were actually learning more. By the end of the semester, however, students were rating successive relearning as more effective and also saying that they felt less anxious when they were using it. Now, why they felt less anxious, I can only speculate. But my hope is that by using this relatively difficult technique, right, it involves taking practice tests, well, they realize, wow, I'm learning the material better. In fact, what I'm going to be asked to do eventually is to take tests over this material. And I'm getting better at taking tests. So in fact, it starts to reduce my anxiety because I'm kind of training myself to get ready for that final exam. So I think at least if we become more and more explicit and have students use these strategies more often, the promissory note is that they're going to enjoy them more because they'll see the benefits, which might have the wonderful added extra effect of reducing their anxiety. Now, this is the first research I know about this, and I hope others do it, but I think it's very promising.
Yeah, that does sound promising. Is that research that's being carried out at the moment, or is that something that we could share with the listeners?
Absolutely share with the listeners. This should be in print right now in the Journal of Educational Psychology.
Great. I will I'll make sure I dig out a link and put it in the description of the podcast. But, the two really standout techniques from your research: practice testing and distributed practice. I hope we can sort of unpick those a little bit more and sort of look at exactly what they might look like in the classroom. So, practice testing, can that be as sort of easy as low stakes quizzes and those sorts of things? Or you mentioned, the anxiety of doing tests, do they need to be slightly more significant to really have an impact?
Quite a bit of research shows that just low stakes testing can have an impact on students' knowledge. And the idea is really straightforward for any teachers who would want to use this. Imagine just beginning or ending each class with a very brief quiz. 2-3 questions about the most important topic from the prior class. And if these quizzes are set up to simulate the final quiz or exam that they'll need to take, that's the high stakes, I think it's very useful to tell your students. One reason they're doing it is so that they can get practice. So when they finally hit that final exam, they'll be a little bit less anxious. But also by doing that, when the students miss these questions, that gives the teacher an opportunity to do right formative evaluation to realize, ooh, they didn't quite get this content. So right at the moment, if the teacher is seeing any kind of misconceptions coming up as the students take this exam, they can quick correct those. Even better, if the students are answering those questions correctly, they get a benefit from doing so. And that will impact their high stakes exam scores. So typically, I set aside 5 minutes, maybe at the beginning of each class, to do some low stakes quizzing, again, on the most important content. And for me, at least, if it's material that I really want the students to learn well, I have no concerns about repeating some of the same questions on that final high stakes exam. It's almost like rewarding them for engaging in the process. So a couple well-developed, even multiple choice questions to begin each class can have a real benefit. And let me qualify that, though, at least when I do this in my own courses with college students, it truly benefits them. And they at least anecdotally say they embrace it more when I explain why I'm doing them. So I be very explicit and let them in on the game that we're doing this to reduce their anxiety. I'm going to help them navigate multiple choice questions, and they're going to learn a little content as well. So I think the low stakes quizzes can have a real major impact on the student learning and show them that quiz is not so bad after all.
And where do you stand on sort of pre-testing, evaluating students' prior knowledge before going into a topic? Is that unnecessary, or does that have a benefit as well?
Well, I think the jury's out with respect to the evidence and how much of an impact it can have on overall retention. I don't see any harm in it to the degree that the students do get a sense about, well, these are the kinds of quizzes I'll be taking. And it highlights, hopefully, if done correctly, what the teacher finds most important with respect to content that's coming up, so it can kind of clue the students in. Personally, as far as long-term impact on retention, I tend to focus myself on post-quizzing, that is after the content has already been introduced, then to see if, to refresh them on it, to see if they understand it. It's going to depend on how much time teachers have. If I only could do one, it would be quizzing after the content has already been presented. But a pretest is absolutely nothing wrong with that.
Okay. And in terms of distributed practice, can that just be a similar level, allowing a few minutes at the end or the beginning of a lesson? Can that be something that teachers can quickly apply to their existing lesson plans, or does that need to be more significant?
Well, again, it depends on the complexity of the content, but just so the teachers understand what you and I mean by spaced practice, let's say I gave a brief quiz at the beginning of a class, just two questions, multiple choice questions. During the next class, I could ask two different questions. That would not be spaced practice. Spaced practice is if during the next class, I ask the same question again, or at least about the same content, so that you're practicing the same content. The reason for spaced practice in this way is critical, because even when, say, a student answers a question on a particular piece of information correctly, they will forget that content. I mean, it's just natural. We forget everything. Thank goodness. Memory system set up, if we remembered everything, it would be a horrible situation, right? So the idea, I use spaced practice in that way. I repeat questions across those quizzes, basically to signal to students that this content is extra important and I want them to remember it. So that's one way a teacher can use spaced practice. I think often spaced practice is best used outside of the classroom when, say, if you're developing worksheets for students to do homework with, then to repeat that content across worksheets. So say if they're learning content A on today, they might have a worksheet over content A today. But then next week, not only give them a worksheet over content B, but then revisit content A again. And I think that kind of spaced practice can be valuable too. Spacing one's activities and repeating those activities is the basis of all mastery. So if students are going to master anything, or if there's some content that you want your students to know really, really well, you're going to have to use this technique. You need to repeat the content over and over again until they get it. So there's no way around it. Anyone that coaches any kind of sports team understands this. We just tend to forget some of these lessons when we're teaching mathematics and biology.
Do you think this is a curriculum problem, or is this a sort of teaching and learning problem? Because just for example, in the UK, I guess a sequenced curriculum in history, you would follow, you'd have the Industrial Revolution and then the First World War, for example. And there's not often a lot of space to sort of recap and move around, and things are built on top of other elements of the course. So do you think this is something that needs to be addressed at a higher level, or is this something that teachers can sort of introduce into their teaching?
I think both, actually. First, that's a great question, Simon. I wish we could solve it. It's definitely, let's start with the curricular issue. It's absolutely a curricular problem. I mean, our curriculum, say for a university system, are antiquated. They're based on a model of education that is no longer relevant, but that can't be changed. There's just too much investment in this particular curriculum to sidestep it at most university levels. Okay, but no, I would definitely, across the 4 years of college, if I were the king, I would probably have a lot more specialty areas where students are just focusing on specific areas that they'll repeat over and over again until they get it right, so on and so forth. Now, we know that kind of curriculum change is not going to be happening, right? To space practice, to repeat content. However, I think this is where teachers can have an impact. So take history, for instance. The events aren't necessarily independent, right? So when you're teaching events, say, in the second year of history, linking those to prior events, that is, getting the space to practice on prior events and seeing how they're intertwined, again, can lead to longer-term retention of it. Personally, and you can tell that I'm not a history teacher, else I'd be using real examples here. Personally, I would take the tactic that there are some basic issues that are consistent with teaching history that I'm going to repeat across the curriculum so that I'm not only learning the event, historical events, but I'm developing a larger understanding of what they mean. And again, I wish I could, if this were psychology, I could give specific examples, but the idea is that themes would be repeated and what the students would take away and that they might retain then 20 years down the line are these larger themes and what they mean, what the history means, right, with respect to being a good citizen and so forth. Obviously, my curriculum wasn't like that. Else, I could remember some of my history right now in these examples. But, you know, so I think teachers can have a role, but there's no way individual teachers can take on the curriculum, which they do not set. The administrators set the curriculum. And here in the United States, unfortunately, sometimes the administrators at a higher level for political reasons set that curriculum. And hence, it's just a mess.
So in terms of creating the better learners, what else needs to be present? We've looked at some of your strategies, but I know for you, things like time management are very important. And are things like self-regulation and those sorts of things, are they things that can be taught from an early age? Are they innate in learners? What else do you think can create that sort of that expert learner?
Expertise here, as far as expert learner, is going to come down, and this is me speculating entirely, Simon. If we could develop techniques and experiences so that children, I'm talking second, third graders, could learn to manage their time, and then that would translate through their entire lives, we will transform society. Time management is the essence of, quite frankly, expertise, mastery, incredible performance, and so forth. So, and I understand why we don't train these skills early on, because a first grader, second grader, third grader, all their time is managed for them, right? We get college students who don't think they need to manage their time. I'm being serious, because they don't think they really need to. Well, they don't think they need to because their time has always been managed for them. So here's a, for example, that happens even at the graduate level, and why I think time management, I'll just get on the soapbox, is so important. We have students now, and this is totally appropriate for grad students, wanting a balance between work and life. That is, they want to have all this extra time to embrace all their life activities, but they want to also embrace their work activities. Well, if they don't manage their time, there's no way to have that balance. Because the idea here is I'm going to stay focused on my work for the time that I've set out, so that when that time is over, I can then focus on my life. Well, when you're just floating and flapping in the wind, beginning your work whenever you kind of want to and beginning your life whenever you want to without managing that, you will feel like you're lost, right? There's no way to be effective at anything. So, again, if I were king here or queen or something like that, I would find a way to develop reasons to teach time management and to show how important it is early in life. I'm not sure how to do that. If I had another career, I think under my belt here to use, I probably would do all my research on time management and how to teach it. Because, wow, when I see effective people, whether they be young students, old students, athletes, or what have you, I'm looking at someone who understands how to manage their time and stay disciplined to that particular time management activity. So I hope I answered your question there. I was kind of babbling.
No, you did. You touched on some home truths there, why I haven't reached such great heights that I might have aspired to. My time management is poor at the best of times. So that really underlined a few things. But I was just going to talk to you about examinations generally, and because obviously your research is all about preparing learners for getting them to retain knowledge. And perhaps part of the reason that research has gone down particularly well is because that's the end goal for educators, right? Unfortunately, getting students through tests. I understand you let your students at Kent fail their first sort of tests of a term just to kind of before you give them the strategies to succeed. Is there a reason behind that?
Yes, there is. Okay, so this is just, it sounds like I'm evil or something. You're withholding good content. When I teach undergraduate courses, I often have freshmen and sophomores. And my courses tend to be mastery courses. And what I mean by that is that students can achieve any grade that they elect to achieve. So if you do poorly on your first exam and you come to me and say, well, John, I can't believe I did so poorly. I really want to excel. I want to get an A. I'm going to give you every chance to overcome that first poor grade. And what I do know by interviewing lots of students is that many students feel that they already know how to study, right? Because what they've used in high school worked for them, but often it doesn't work well at all in college. So I withhold my basically day instruction on effective strategies and preparing for the exam until after they've had that first exam experience. And the reason for this is simple. It's like if you did poorly on that exam, I think it's pretty good evidence that you did not prepare properly for it. So I can come into class and say, look, if you did not get a grade that you wanted, right, I can help you excel on the next class. In fact, I'm going to show you how to excel on your next exam. And if you embrace these and do well, we're going to wipe out that first grade, right? We're going to move forward and you're going to know a technique that works well. And I think it really does impress the students in the sense that, geez, John's right. I didn't prepare well. And what he's suggesting I do is different and he's going to help us succeed. And when I used to do this, first day of class, I would go over effective study techniques. Well, that was way too early. Not only did the students who were listening to them realize, oh, that seems like a little bit more work than I'm used to doing. So they just turn off, right? Because it's what they're doing, it already works. Plus, it's well before that first exam, so they just forget about it. So I didn't find that was effective. Whereas now, at least my hope is that the students who don't do as well as they should might have a higher likelihood of embracing the new strategies that I'll be teaching them. So again, it seems a little bit evil, but just for anyone who's listening, I do give the students a chance to make up their poor grades and really learn that content. So
the world where John is king, it's there's some evil elements in there as well.
Maybe I'm more like the prince, right?
We'll go with prince. There's been a huge focus on exams in this country, in the UK, over the past couple of summers, obviously, because they haven't been able to happen as they usually would. So in the world where John's kingdom, how would you test students? Would you keep exams in the way they are now, or do you see a different way forward?
Wow, Simon, that is a really deep question. No, and admittedly, those statewide exams, I will just admit, here's where my knowledge is limited. Because I do not do a lot of research on those. My guess is, though, there are lots of valuable reasons to have the statewide exams, if nothing but trying to identify students who are falling behind. But that's falling behind knowledge-wise. I think if really I can tap a magic wand, I think we'd go back to the curricular discussion and focus less on exams and more on the best way to implement knowledge in the classroom to develop long-term retention. So we wouldn't have to worry about the exams, because we know when the students went through the curriculum, they would be learning the content we're teaching because they're going to review it until they get it right. Unfortunately, what this would mean, and don't get me wrong, I'm not sure everyone would be happy with this world, because one implication is that we would be teaching our students less in that world. So, well, when you teach students less, then some kind of content probably is off the island. That is, everything can't be equally important. And then the question is, who decides what's important? And then we get into this whole political rigmarole, what do students need? It gets complicated. So, and my magic wand, what I'd love to do is just tap multiple different curricular changes so we could see what works best and then make reform after that. I'm not sure what to do. Wow.
It's a big question.
Well, I've never had so much power before, Simon. It just makes me nervous. What if I fail?
That crown's sitting a little bit heavier now, right?
Well, yes. I might take it off, actually.
John, you're going to be speaking at the World Education Summit next March. What can we expect from your session there?
I'm going to talk about successive relearning, something I mentioned multiple times today, and really throw the gauntlet down to education researchers that we should be doing more of this mastery-focused work, but also explain to teachers who are coming, which I suspect will be mainly my audience, about how they can make successive relearning work for their students as they're teaching. Even if it's just a small use of this effective technique, I think they'll find if they use it just in the right way for the content they really want their students to learn and retain, they'll see an impact in their own classroom. So I'm really excited to tell them what I've learned about successive relearning and how they could potentially use it for their students.
Brilliant. Okay, great. Well, we'll look forward to that. John, thank you very much for joining me today. It's been fascinating. Really enlightening. And I'll point listeners to that piece of research that you mentioned earlier. But thanks again for joining us.
Thanks for having me, Simon.